May it please the court. My name is Kim Bruch. I'm appearing today on behalf of Plaintiff Appellant Neuromonitoring Associates. Your Honor, it is my intention to reserve probably 4 or 5 minutes. Any reminder would be helpful, although I understand the responsibility to monitor it myself. Your Honor, this case involves the application of statute of limitations. First and foremost, Neuromonitoring Associates, which for ease we generally refer to as NMA, suggests that in this case, sufficient questions of fact existed so that the entry of summary judgment by the district court was inappropriate and premature. The complaint was filed January 5th, 2010, and contains two claims. It's a claim for breach of contract and a claim for a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. NMA suggests that it submitted sufficient evidence to overcome a summary judgment motion regarding the application of the statute of limitations because there are questions of fact regarding when the statute began to run, as well as whether the statute can be equitably tolled if it indeed started running in 2005, as Centura suggests. Alternatively, the breach could also be construed as a continuing one in nature, and NMA would therefore be permitted to at least pursue claims dating 3 years back from when it filed the complaint. So everything revolves around the statute of limitations, even though there are several distinct issues and arguments underneath that broad overarching issue.
Question. I think that a breach occurred when I read the complaint, it said that entering into agreements with other nerve monitoring companies was a breach. So I take it entering into these contracts with other companies, the entry of the contract would be itself a breach, correct?
I think that the actual act of allowing the companies into the operating rooms would be the breach. If you look at the exhibit attached to NMA's contract, it had specific facilities listed where it was to be the exclusive provider. Centura surely had more facilities than those listed. I think there were 5 or 6 on the exhibit. So theoretically, Centura could have agreements with other companies at facilities that are not listed on the exhibit. Whether they did or not, I'm not sure we ever got that far in the litigation. So I think where Your Honor's question is headed is, we were obtaining information as far back as 2005 that there may be a breach, but entering into a contract in and of itself may not be a breach. Allowing one of these other competitors or companies to go into a Centura facility not listed on the exhibit would not be a breach. The breach would be actually permitting and credentialing someone to come into one of the facilities that we were contractually guaranteed the exclusivity right under the contract.
Whatever the date is when Centura said to Company A, all right, you're credentialed, or the individuals, you're credentialed and you are now allowed to provide the service at our hospitals. That would be the date of the breach.
Depending on the facility, maybe not. Like I said, I don't think there's an actual breach until they enter into an agreement that would maybe specifically allow them to come into one of those facilities if it was specified, could possibly be a breach. But surely, if they allowed one of them to actually step in and perform the monitoring service at one of those facilities.
But isn't it, I mean, kind of expanding on what Judge Miller was asking, as I understand the record, it's undisputed that sometime in 2005, NMA was aware that other companies were providing these kind of services in at least some of the hospitals designated in your agreement.
I think there's a question of timing, whether it occurred in 2005 or not. The record does show that in 2005, NMA was told that at least one other company had been permitted to enter into one of these facilities, or more specifically, it's cited to in the brief. The actual exchange that occurred was NMA was called to be scheduled for a procedure, and the scheduler said, this company, Surgical Concepts, can't do it. We'd like you to do it. So it wasn't even that Surgical Concepts had necessarily been in there. They said, they can't do this service. We want you to come do it. That prompted NMA, after the fact, to make the phone call to the facility at Centura and say, we're very confused. We thought we had an exclusivity provision. I believe the deposition testimony that's cited then says Centura responded by saying, well, that's very odd. We had no idea that occurred, and it would be weird that they would call you and say that because they know you have an exclusivity provision. We'll figure this out. So there was this potential information that somebody may have either had rights to do it. There was nothing that said they actually did it at that point in time. And then Centura coming in and saying, yes, they did it. Now, I think you're probably also referencing a letter that NMA then got directly from that competitor that later in 2005 said, yeah, we're doing work for Centura.
Well, not only that, I mean, there's, as I remember the record, there was evidence presented at the, in the renewed summary judgment motion from your own client that said sometime in 2005, they actually believed that the hospital was in breach of the agreement. And they made a strategic decision to keep going on because they wanted to maximize getting business.
I think that's the way Centura has construed that testimony, and that's part of the reason that we've suggested that summary judgment was premature, because I think a lot of inferences have been drawn from what was actually said. The actual deposition transcript, I believe, and understanding that the communication with the competitor and the communication with Centura to resolve this issue are kind of intertwined and happening at the same time, and they have a competitor saying, yeah, we're performing services. It may be broader than those five facilities, but it is, you know, probably in contravention to your exclusivity provision. And NMA going straight to Centura and saying, do we have a problem here? And Centura is affirmatively saying, no, 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 we're going to investigate this. We're going to make it right. We understand your exclusivity provision. And it's coupled with, Centura wants to just rely on that statement and say that's enough. But it's,
I'm sorry, you're saying Centura affirmatively said, no, this is not occurring?
No, they said, I believe the specific Surgical Concepts testimony was they said, we didn't know, and certainly they shouldn't have called you because they know you have an exclusivity provision. Then the next statements, when they were talking generally about this, the statements that were made to them were, we're going to investigate it. I think they basically said, we don't know what's going on. We understand you have an exclusivity provision. That was verified, and we're going to make it right. There definitely were statements in the deposition where Centura told them, we're going to make it right. We're going to take care of it. This is then coupled, and this is the, I think, where you have to take the facts as a whole, with this agreement is renewable every year. And every year, Centura allowed it to renew with the exclusivity provision remaining unchanged in it. If they had no intention to make this exclusive or to honor it, they should have terminated the contract, because everyone acknowledges that there was a no-foul termination provision. They could have done it any time they wanted, and they didn't. Coupled with the statements they're making to NMA saying, we're going to take care of it, they're renewing the contract. And then the third fact that we think is critical in terms of summary judgment being premature on this issue is, at one point when NMA did contact one of the Centura facilities during this time frame, you know, they said, we think there may be a problem. All of a sudden, their caseload went up. And Centura is telling them, we're going to take care of it. We're going to make it right. Their caseload goes up. So it appears that if there was an issue, if someone didn't know they had an exclusivity provision, it's at least been resolved, you know, in part with respect to this. So it appears Centura is doing exactly what they said they were doing, which is following the contract. And then once again, they continually keep renewing the contract without removing this provision. It wasn't until 2009 when the NMA once again went to them and kind of said, you know, we really think that there may be an issue here, that they finally said, you're going to get a new contract. And this time they gave them one without the exclusivity provision. NMA said, okay, well, now, you know, it's clear to us what's happening. They file suit. Then that contract is terminated. And then on top of that, to make it even worse, Centura goes in and actually revokes their credentials and their privileges. So even outside of that contract, if a surgeon wants NMA to perform the services for them, they can't do it. They're not even permitted to operate at the Centura facilities now.
You're at 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I think that those facts clearly show that from an equitable perspective, there was sufficient evidence at least to get past this. I think when you look at the...
Let me just stop you there for a second, because I think you just said from an equitable standpoint. And as I heard your entire argument for the last 2 or 3 minutes, it seems to me all of that plays into whether the court got it right on the issue of equitable tolling.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's a separate issue from whether you discovered or should have discovered the breach originally in 2005. And the arguments that I heard you making, I think, do relate to the equitable tolling issue. But I'm not sure that they get you anywhere on the whether the statute first began to run in 2005.
Well, I think they are intertwined, because when NMA didn't sit on its hands when it got the first information in 2005. You know, so therefore, you have, should they have discovered it? They go to Centura. That's where I think the conduct and the equitable tolling kicks in right away, is when they go to NMA or go to Centura and say, you know, is this happening? How do we remedy it? And they're assured that they're going to be taken care of. And then it appears from some of these other facts that they are taking care of it, that they do intend to comply with their contract, that they continue to renew it. I think it all goes back to knew or should have known. One other critical fact, Your Honor, when it comes down to determining did they know or should they have known in 2005, it hasn't to this day been established that a violation actually occurred in April 2005 when the court held that it did, because in discovery, Centura said, we don't know. So they haven't even confirmed what was going on at that point. They said the records were hard to find. They were working on it, but it has not been determined that even occurred. The information came from a third party. NMA went to Centura, and Centura said, we'll investigate, we'll figure it out, and then took some actions that made it seem like they did.
Your client, they believed there were 2005.
I think they testified that the information they got regarding Surgical Concepts led them to believe that was the case, but that was prior to going to Centura, addressing this issue, and then being subject to the various representations and subsequent renewals of the contract that then led them to believe, even if there was one, it was, you know, an inadvertent error, they corrected it was someone that didn't know the contract. So even if they did believe that, it either was not verified by Centura, so they were led to believe either no breach occurred, which is still possible. There is no evidence in the record of what happened in 2005 other than the letter from the competitor, or Centura assured them we're going to correct it. I will reserve the last 2 minutes. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Chad Nita. I am here to represent Centura. Moving straight to some of the points that were just addressed in the oral argument. Your Honors, the trial court found on summary judgment that NMA knew or should have known of this alleged breach. And the trial court specifically pointed to the letter that you were discussing earlier. Now, this letter was in fact a response to a letter from NMA, a cease and desist letter in which NMA told their competitor, stop providing neuromonitoring services at these Centura facilities. And that competitor responded on April 13th, 2005 and said, make no mistake, we are providing intraoperative monitoring services and will continue to do so. The trial court found, based on that, that the claim accrued at that point, that NMA knew or should have known. Nothing that we've seen in any of the appellate record gives any indication that that was an incorrect finding. There's no denial that the letter was received. There's no denial of what the letter states. In fact, there were numerous other facts. It wasn't just this letter. Both principals from NMA testified that they saw personally at covered Centura facilities personnel from other companies providing neuromonitoring services in 2005 and 2006. In fact, they testified that one of their own employees quit, went to work for Surgical Concepts, and they saw that person in the fall of 2005 providing neuromonitoring services at a covered Centura facility. So, Your Honors, there is no question that they were aware that companies other than neuromonitoring associates were providing neuromonitoring services. Now, with respect to the argument that Centura somehow told them that they would take care of that, Your Honor, there's no indication in the record that Centura said anything other than they would look into it. By no means a claim that they would look into something is not the same as saying they were going to cure it. There was no promise. There were no representations of a timeline. There was no affirmative statement that they would fix the situation. But moreover, one of the principals of the NMA testified at her deposition that despite what she heard from Centura, she personally believed in 2005 that Centura was going to continue to allow other companies to provide neuromonitoring services. So not only did Centura not make an affirmative representation, whatever they did represent, the person they represented it to did not believe that they were going to cease. All of that, Your Honor, supports the trial court's finding that NMA knew or should have known in April of 2005 that companies other than NMA were providing neuromonitoring services. Now, Your Honor, with respect to the equitable tolling argument, the trial court also had a specific finding that said you can't have equitable tolling because NMA, you knew this was going on. You knew other companies were doing this. This wasn't hidden from you. One of the five elements that the court recognized ain't gone yet was the relevant knowledge of the underlying facts. NMA can't deny that they knew. What they'll say is, well, we didn't know that Centura wasn't going to fix it. Well, even if that were the requirement, which it's not, again, NMA's principal testified she didn't think they were going to fix it. So the fact that they knew these facts were, that this action was going on and did nothing to stop it, takes away any equitable argument under a tolling. Moreover, there is direct testimony that the two principals of NMA conferred with each other in 2005 about whether or not to object to other companies being allowed to provide the services. And both principals testified that they came up with a strategy, which was to continue to do as much work as possible for Centura to maximize the amount of money they were going to make. So in that situation, for them to claim that they should be equitably told when they made the decision for their own business reasons to continue to allow this alleged breach to happen, there isn't any equity in their favor.
Counselor, let me ask you, is it your position, your client's position, that there was a single breach of contract and that occurred in April of 2005?
No, Your Honor. As the principals of NMA testified, there were companies other than Surgical Concepts that were providing neuromonitoring services.
A separate breach each and every time, and I know it's you're contesting maybe whether there are breaches. I'm not trying to tie it, but is it your position that an alleged breach occurred each and every time someone came in from a competitor and performed a service?
Well, no, Your Honor. It's Centura's position that the underlying contractual issue is exclusivity, and our position is that if exclusivity was breached, it can only happen a single time, the first time, and it doesn't somehow re-heal or come back and resume being exclusive until the next person is allowed.
So it would have been in April or maybe shortly before that, 2005.
That is...
So that's what I'm saying. You're saying there's only one breach of...
I apologize. In that context, yes, that the breach occurred and it did not reoccur later. But
how do you distinguish, and I know you talk a little bit about this in your brief, how do you distinguish the rationale of the Barker case, which seems to say just the opposite of what you're saying, that where this, you have this continuing obligation, that there are a series of breaches, and that the statute essentially renews each time there's a new breach. And I guess this is the alternative argument that the plaintiff is making, is that if they lose everything else, at the very least, they want to be able to have a trial on the breaches if any, and maybe there weren't any, but that occurred 3 years or less before the date they filed their lawsuit, which, and they argue that Barker controls that. So how do you deal with that?
Well, Your Honor, we have two responses to that. First, we agree with the trial court, who specifically in his decision addressed Barker and specifically distinguished Barker on the grounds that, again, NMA was aware of the underlying facts. In the Barker case, the injured party was unaware of the continuing violation, and therefore, they, from an equitable perspective, there was no reason in their situation.
Yeah, but that's all equitable stuff. Why is that? I mean, I know the trial court said that, and I guess what the plaintiff is asking us is to rule that the trial court was wrong, and I'm trying to understand why that makes a difference on this issue as opposed to some other issue.
Well, from our perspective, the Barker case was specifically dealing with protective covenants in a very, and so there were, the argument is we need to take a very specific body of law in protective covenants dealing with real property and extend it over into the situation. And we think not only is that not appropriate, but the fact that they were aware of the underlying breach and chose to allow it to happen mitigates further against trying to transfer an established body of law that's been recognized to be in a narrow set of circumstances and apply it into a situation such as this.
Why isn't this just like a protective covenant?
Well, the protective covenants dealing with real property, Your Honor, this isn't a property right that they had. It's a contractual obligation.
But Barker isn't decided on the basis of property rights, is it?
Well, Your Honor, we think that was the underlying theme that went into the Barker decision. But also, with respect to when you have the knowledge, in our situation, our argument is simple. If you're aware of a breach and you allow it to continue to happen, which is what has exactly happened in these circumstances, if you were to apply the holding or the theory of Barker, that would eviscerate the point of having a statute of limitations and would effectively say, well, the statute of limitations goes away. Your claim won't accrue as long as there is a continuing obligation. In the same context, if you owe somebody money, if you don't pay them today, is it a breach again tomorrow if you don't pay them? Is it a breach the next day if you continue not to pay them?
Well, yeah, it might be, for example, under an installment contract.
But under the theory that they're presenting here, it's not an installment contract. It's a single payment, and every day that you don't pay is just constituting a separate breach. If that were the case, there would be no statute of limitations. It would be any claim for breach of contract could be brought within 3 years at any point.
Do you have any case supporting your side of the argument on that?
No, Your Honor, there are no cases dealing with applying Barker theory into the context that NMA is suggesting that it be applied.
When you say there are no cases, you mean in Colorado or anywhere?
In Colorado.
Okay.
And recognize that they did recognize the case in New York. For the reason we said, we don't believe that equitable tolling would apply in the situation. The equities simply don't favor that resolution. And we think there's no question that factually, that the claim accrued in April 2005. NMA, however, brings additional arguments, some of which we haven't had the opportunity yet to discuss. One argument, and it has been a central argument, was the belief that this should be covered by a 6-year statute of limitations rather than a 3-year statute of limitations, under the theory that this is a cognizable debt and fits under the exception to the 3-year statute rule. From Centura's perspective, Your Honors, this is not an action for a specific debt. The complaint doesn't claim that they're owed a specific amount. In fact, the complaint alleges that they're entitled to lost revenues that will be determined at some point. But more to the point, their own damages expert acknowledged that he is not calculating the amount they should have been paid. His job was to calculate, and it took him 45 pages to do it, was to calculate the amount of profits he alleges they should have made after their costs, and he had 7 or 8 different categories of costs that he had to deduct. In that type of a situation, this is not an easily ascertainable debt that can be done with simple multiplication. And for that reason, we think it's not appropriate to apply a 6-year statute of limitations. And more to the point, there were no services provided. NMA, at best, is arguing that they lost the opportunity to provide the service, not that they actually did a service for which they should be paid. So for that reason, again, there's not a cognizable debt that they're owed. They're suing for damages for a lost opportunity. And that is not the same thing that the 6-year statute of limitations was created to deal with.
Okay. To Barker, But you said that there were distinguished Barker from this case, and I only heard one, that Barker relates to protective covenants on real estate.
We also were distinguished from the fact that they were not aware that in the Barker case, they were unaware of the continuing violation. They didn't, whereas we believe that NMA, with the knowledge that the continuing violation was that they chose to allow to occur, argues against applying a continuing violation principle. And so that's separate and apart from whether or not we should take it from a protective covenant into this context. The fact that they were aware of the underlying facts and allowed it to happen makes it puts it in a position where if you were to say that this is a continuing violation and characterize it that way, our argument again is that every contract at that point would be characterized as a continuing violation where the party knowingly allowed a breach to occur, did nothing to stop it, and waited for a certain number of years, allowing their damages to rack up.
Wouldn't that just be a defense on the merits rather than totally defeating the argument on the statute of limitations here?
I'm sorry, really a defense on the merits that it was that they knew and they should have known better?
Yeah, I mean, if you make the argument that they knew about all of this, right. Why doesn't that argument just go to the merits of, you know, whether they were damaged or whether there was
a waiver?
Yeah.
Well, we'd argue that that's why it's inappropriate to try to extend this theory to a different set of situations because they knew and were aware of it. And Your Honors, we should also make the point that, again, the covenant, it's an exclusivity agreement. There is absolutely no law that's presented from NMA that would argue that an exclusivity agreement can be repeatedly breached, whereas, and I apologize, but the way I always liken it to is a person can't be a little bit pregnant. You can't be a little bit exclusive. Either it is an exclusive deal or it is not an exclusive deal. So, Judge Miller, to the question you asked me earlier, when did the breach occur? The exclusivity was breached at the point the first company other than NMA was allowed to provide services. It didn't resume and become exclusive again. And if you layer on top of that, Your Honors, this notion that NMA was aware that these breaches were happening and did nothing to stop the breaches from happening, and now they're going to say, well, but still you should treat it as if exclusivity somehow reformed itself prior to each breach, and there's no legal basis for that to apply. And that is a key part for a continuing violation to occur, that there has to be a renewed, as in an installment contract. There are new payments, renewed duties. There's nothing in this instance that's been pointed to.
But there were renewals of the agreement.
Well, and Your Honor's argument is, with their knowledge, those were renewed, which reaffirms our position and our understanding of how the agreement should work.
But the renewals, other than the very last one, all had the exclusivity. I mean, there's no question about what that provision says.
I agree, Your Honor, but there's also no question from Centura's perspective about how this agreement operated in effect. And our position is they ratified the party's conduct of the agreement each time it was renewed. For them to argue that we renewed the agreement and that somehow brought back their faith that the exclusivity would somehow apply, even their principals testified they didn't believe that to be the case. And so at that point, it becomes a legal fiction that somehow exclusivity was resumed by renewal of an agreement when no one that was operating, neither side, believed there was actually any resumption of exclusivity, nor was there any indication that there would be any resumption of exclusivity at any point.
Is there evidence in the record that no
The evidence, Your Honor, is that Centura looked into the claims that NMA brought and did not believe that anything needed to be done differently. And that's what's indicated.
Stated explicitly, I'll look into this.
They responded that they looked into it and didn't offer to change anything, Your Honor, on multiple occasions in letters. I don't know if that answers your question.
I'd like to briefly address one issue that came up, I think, was the renewal. Certainly, I think one point that can be made there is that each and every time the contract was renewed, there would have to be a breach of that particular agreement. And so there would have to be an ongoing, we knew that it occurred in 2006, 2007, 2008, and a specific breach for each one of those. So I think it can be construed as that way as well. Now, with respect to the...
Can I ask you a question about the renewals? The contract that's attached to the complaint is the one dated 2004.
Yes.
And as I read it, it basically says, unless either one of us does something, this is essentially going to renew automatically.
That's correct.
Okay, so is that what happened, or did you actually sign new contracts? Because I don't see any new contracts in the record.
Up until 2009, I believe it automatically.
Just happened automatically.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Is it your position that every time a competitor performed a service at one of the specified facilities, that was a new breach of the contract?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
If you follow the Barker case, I think that's exactly what it says as well. The specific language in there, it says that the court found that there were successive and repetitive breaches that resulted in it being determined a continuing breach of the covenant. And that is why it held that the statute of limitations didn't expire, and that it merely cut off from the three-year time period from when the claim was filed. Another issue with respect to that Barker case, the trial court in this case distinguished Barker, saying that in our case, it didn't apply because NMA had some knowledge that these breaches were continuing. I don't think that the Barker case is any different when you read it. The case indicates that it was a horse property and that they were actually constructing structures and operating it as a horse farm for 8 years before the complaint was filed. And I think it shows that they had knowledge as well, though it wasn't specifically addressed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel, for your helpful arguments. This matter will stand submitted to the court, and an opinion will issue in due course.